ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Australia's always been the lucky country. Sunshine, beaches, and that one magpie that always seems to know where you live.
Yeah, get away from my chip, please. Luck might not cut it anymore.
So can we make our own luck and turn this complicated world to our advantage?
That's our global roaming summer season. Can Australia surf the world's chaos without wiping out?
Fresh new episodes all summer. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, Claire Nichols here. So happy to be back with you for a fresh new year of The Book Show. The Book Show is where I bring you conversations with your favourite fiction authors. And what a way to kick things off for 2026. The British writing legend, Philip Pullman, is here. The Australian actor turned author Zoe Tourakis is here too. They'll join me later. But Philip Pullman, he's best known, of course, for his beloved fantasy trilogy, His Dark Materials. The first book in that series, The Northern Lights, was published in 1995, and this is a series that has gone on to define Philip. In fact, his new book is the latest in a companion trilogy he started in 2017, The Book of Dust. This last instalment has been billed as the final adventure for his heroine, Lyra Balakwa. The final book in the Book of Dust trilogy is called The Rose Field. Philip Pullman, welcome to The Book Show.
Thank you. It's great to talk to you.
So this story, Philip, has been a part of your life for 30 years. What is it like to have this world and these characters in your head for so long?
Well, it had to share the space inside my head with a number of other projects because I haven't just been focusing on this. I've got, I've had other books to write and things to think about and a family to live with and all that sort of thing. So I haven't been holed up like some obsessive hermit poring over my books in a cave somewhere with no contact with the outside world. So it's been part of my life, but part of my life, not the whole of my life. But it is a long time. You're quite right. 30 years, yeah.
And that time now seems to have come to an end.
I saw the end coming a long time before I got to it. So I was prepared for the fact, obviously, that there would be a time when I wasn't writing this book anymore. But I've got other things in the waiting to be written. For a long time, I've been thinking about writing about my childhood. And part of which took place in Australia. And that might be something I tackle next.
We've got to hear more about your childhood in Australia. How did you end up here?
My father and then my stepfather were both in the Royal Air Force. This would be in the late 50s, middle 50s. My stepfather was posted to Woomera in South Australia, where they were testing rockets or something. I don't know what it was. I was only a little boy. But we came out here to Australia by sea, which is the way you travel long distance in those days, which was thrilling. It was lovely to go around the world down through the Suez Canal and the Indian Ocean and so on, and eventually land in Australia, in Adelaide. And I enjoyed it from the moment we landed. Everything about Australia was different and new and exciting, not least the fact that you could get proper comics here, by which I mean Superman and Batman. You see, these were harder to get in England in those days because there was a great scare about American horror comics, and all American comics were sort of difficult to get, and you were supposed to be frightened of them and all this sort of stuff. But we had Superman comics and Disney comics and Batman comics, and I loved these because I loved that way of telling a story. And if I could draw, I'd probably be a comic, a writer of comics now rather than a novelist. So that was one thing. There was the weather, there was fruit in the garden. We had a nectarine tree and a something else tree and a peach tree. So the whole panorama of life was different and wider and stranger and more exciting.
How many years were you here for?
Not all that long, just 18 months really, a year and a half. But some of it next to the sea, part of Adelaide called Glenelg, which was sort of on the beach. And there was a lot of swimming involved and a lot of messing about on the beach and in the water. So that was great fun.
So you knew you loved being a reader. When did you know, Philip Pullman, that you wanted to write your own stories?
Quite early on. There was no TV in Australia then. At least this was 1956. And in Adelaide, there was no TV. So we listened to the radio. TV came along, incidentally, as a result, I think, of the 56 Olympics, which were held in Melbourne. And, of course, mm-hmm. everybody wanted to see the Olympics. But in our house, it was just the radio. And there were such a lot of exciting serials for children and for grown-ups, and detective stories and cowboy stories and Superman. Even Superman was on the radio. So we listened a lot to that. And I used to imitate those stories when I was telling stories to my younger brother. And I just pretended I was on the radio telling stories. That was something I enjoyed doing enormously. Writing it down, well, yeah, I did a bit of that, but mostly it was just oral storytelling then. Writing down came later.
Wow. I want to go to the beginning of The Northern Lights, this series. Do you remember what the initial seeds were for this story?
I do. This was in 1993. Oh, doesn't that sound a long time ago? 1993, I wanted to write a story that was a kind of not realistic story, but at the same time, I didn't want to go all over, Tolkien and C.S. Lewis and that sort of thing. I wanted to do a story that started with somebody overhearing something they shouldn't overhear. So my heroine, Lyra, who is about 11, in the first chapter of Northern Lights, hides away in a place where she shouldn't be, and she overhears a conversation between the dons, the fellows, the professors of the college where she happens to be living. And this sounds very exciting to her, and the story just starts like that. I didn't know what she was going to overhear. I didn't know what she was going to do or what was going to happen after that. I just let the story develop. So I learned from that never to make a plan. It's a bad idea, I think, to make a plan before you start writing a story, because the story you end up writing might not want to follow the plan. It might want to go off somewhere else. So always follow the story and never a plan.
Wow. I mean, I find that amazing because these books are so detailed. There is so much happening in them. They're dealing with really big ideas. The fact that you're going in without a plan, that gives me chills.
Well, what I should qualify that by is to say you should make a plan, but wait till your book's finished and then make a plan. Because then you can see what you've got, and you can see what you need to move around, what you need to cut, where you need to add a bit, that sort of thing. So your plans are necessary, but they shouldn't come first. Never let the book be ruled by a plan. Let the book rule itself and discover itself. And then you can tidy it up and clarify it and make it run more smoothly.
And when you were writing Northern Lights, you were already a published author at that stage. So when you were working on this, did you know in the process that this was going to be something special?
I knew it was going to be something special for me. Because I had the sort of excitement you get when you're at the beginning of a long story with all kinds of possibilities leading from it. I knew that was going to be exciting for me. What I didn't know, of course, what nobody knows, is whether anybody else is going to be interested. I was very lucky with this book because it was published in 95. It won a prize. It became a bit of a bestseller. It was sold in America and it did well there. And because people liked it, they were keen to read the second part and then the third part when they appeared. So I was lucky. I can't deny that talent and hard work had something to do with it, but you mustn't discount luck. I was lucky to be writing this book at a time when there were a lot of people interested in reading it.
The character of Lyra, I think readers just fell in love with her straight away. What is it about Lyra Balakwa that makes her so wonderful to you, Philip Pullman?
Well, one thing is that she's as puzzled as I was when I was writing it. She doesn't know what this mystery is that she finds herself in the middle of. She's desperate to find out. So we are with her as she finds out what's going on and who the people are who seem to be pursuing her and what this mysterious thing called dust is. She's desperately keen to find out. And also she's a bit of a rebel and she doesn't like being told what to do. So she's always rebelled a little bit and argued with the people who are in charge of her. And when she runs away to escape from them and to find out what the truth is, we sort of run, we're eager to run with her. And luckily, as I say, people stayed with her right through to the end of that book, when she learned that, well, afterwards she has learned a great deal about life and death, and she's fallen in love, and she's lost her very young lover. She's very young too. It's her first experience of many, many things. And at the end of that book, she's back home in Oxford, at peace, a little sorrowful, but also satisfied that she's done her best. And after about 10 years go by, then we start the second trilogy, The Book of Dust.
Mm, in which you went back to her, first of all, as a baby.
This was a bit of a trick I was playing. The first book of the second trilogy goes way back in time to before the first one, before Lyra, when Lyra's just born. Lyra is a baby in La Belle Sauvage, which was a bit of a surprise to some readers. And they said, is this a prequel or a sequel, or what is it? I used to say, well, it's an equal. So it was not a prequel or a sequel, it was an equal. But in that first book, we meet Malcolm, 11-year-old boy, who finds himself by chance, by accident, in charge of and looking after this little baby, Lyra, who's about 6 months old, I guess. And he saves her from a big flood, and he takes her to safety, and they have all sorts of adventures on the way, which later come back as reminders and as things he remembers and she half remembers when the second book of the Book of Dust comes along, when she's about 20. So she goes in the second trilogy from being 6 months old to 20 years old, and for the rest of the story, she's an adult.
Mm. I mean, I think people have so loved following this character through her life. And of course, you know, you're responsible for a whole lot of kids called Lyra out there, Philip. I think there's a whole generation of Lyras out there. What does it feel like to know that's so loved?
That's great. And I quite often get asked to sign a book for Lyra because, you know, she's my granddaughter or she's my niece or my daughter's Lyra. Can you sign a book for her? So naturally, I always put for the real Lyra when I sign the book.
I think the other thing that really captured readers from the start was this idea of demons, these animal companions, the soul in animal form. Where did this come from, Philip?
It just walked into my mind. When I first started it, as I described just now, I had the idea of Lyra going into a room where she wasn't supposed to be and hiding and overhearing things. Well, that's all very well, but if you just have her, you have to tell the reader what she's feeling and what she's thinking. And it's so much more dramatic if she had someone to talk to. But she couldn't have a human person with her because he'd have to hide as well. So I thought of the idea of her having a demon who is part of her nature, her character. But he has the form of it varies with children. They can change shape from a moth to a snake to a rat to a dog to whatever. When you've grown up, the demon settles. Demon shape settles, and you know what sort of person you are. That's what I discovered in the first few chapters of Northern Lights. And it's an idea that was very useful all the way through. In fact, I realized on the very final pages of this new book, The Rosefield, after I don't know how many hundreds or maybe thousands of pages, something new I could do with the idea of the demon. And that shows what a lucky idea it was, how rich it was in possibilities. So I was very glad I thought of that. It's probably the best idea I ever had.
Wow, it's got to be so thrilling to have an idea like that.
Well, the book didn't really get started until I realized that Lyra did have a demon. And once it did, then she could go and hide and they could whisper together and they could talk about what's happening and he could say, be careful, and she could say, oh, quiet, keep quiet. So there's a sort of tension between the two of them, which isn't present when there's only one person there. And I found it enormously useful all the way through for her to have someone to talk to and for him to have a reason for clinging to her because, you know, she makes him feel safe. But he's a bit of a wild character too. And in the second part of the Book of Dust, the second trilogy, they have a terrible argument. Now, this is a puzzle because people can't leave their demons. They're inseparable. They're lifelong companions. What happens if you don't like your demon or if you argue with them and you sort of pull yourselves apart? What happens? Well, that was another idea I explored. And it's about human psychology, really. This is what the story is about. It's about growing up and discovering who you are and discovering how to be grown up and how to leave your childhood behind and what all these things mean. Again, it was a very lucky idea, I think, The Demon.
And in this final book in the series, The Book of Dust, Lyra's demon Pan is off looking for something that Lyra has lost, and that is her imagination. Can you explain, Philip?
Well, as she grows up, in between the first trilogy and the second, as she grows up, she's become sort of mildly intoxicated, you might say, by ideas she's found in books she's read. And some of these books have left her in a state of unhappiness or difficulty or puzzlement or mystery. And as it turns out, Pantalaimon, her demon, is worried that she has lost her imagination because she's not the same Lyra that she was. And is she growing up to be hard and cold and unimaginative? What's happening to her? And he sort of pictures it in the way a demon would. He says, well, your imagination's gone. I better go and look for it. So he sets off to find her imagination. And she has to follow him to see what he finds out and where he's gone. That was a good story basis too.
I think we're all probably a little guilty of losing some of our imagination as we grow up, aren't we?
Yeah, that's probably true. I'm very interested in the difference between innocence and experience in terms of William Blake, great English poet. But other poets of the Romantic era, which I love, Wordsworth and Coleridge in particular, were fascinated by the difference between the child and the adult. Heaven lies about us in our infancy, said Wordsworth. When we're very young, we seem to see that world as new and bright and shining and exciting. But then when we grow up, shades of the prison house begin to close about the growing boy, in Wordsworth's terms. And that's really what happens to Lyra in the second book and then in this final book. But she finds a way through, I have to say that.
Of course. Well, she has to, right? We've been with her for so long.
Well, exactly.
There's been a lot made of these books, Philip, and the representation of what's called the Holy Church in the book. It's something that looks a lot like the real world Catholic Church. I want to go back to when you were first writing these books, you know, starting with Northern Lights. Was it a very clear intention for these books to be a criticism of religion?
Well, yes and no. They turned out like that, but that wasn't an intention. I don't think convincing stories can be written about intentions. It's not intention that makes a story. It's, the need to follow and find out what's going on. It's the imagination.
I get the sense, though, Philip, that the backlash that came, you know, particularly from the church, was something you kind of enjoyed.
Well, there wasn't much of a backlash except in America. I didn't expect it to be because the English church, the Church of England and the Episcopalian Church, as it's called in America, the Anglican Communion is on the whole pretty broad-minded and sensible and up-to-date. I wasn't expecting much of a backlash, and in fact, there wasn't one. There were a few places in America in particular where they refused to have the book in the library. But, you know, that always has the opposite effect from what they want. They want the book to be banned and no one to read it. But the only effect of saying, you must not have this book in your library, it's dangerous, is to make people want to go and buy it. And so they do.
Fantastic. You completed the first trilogy with The Amber Spyglass in 2000. At that point in time, Philip Pullman, did you think you were done with Lyra's story?
I sort of did, yeah, but there was always what to do with Lyra. She is about 12 at the end of the first trilogy. What's she going to do? She's had this amazing adventure. She's been to the world of the dead. She's been nearly to the North Pole. She's shared fights with polar bears. Is she going to just go home and go to school and play netball? No, she's not. Other things are going to happen and other places. There are other places to visit and other adventures to have. So it had to continue, really.
Mm, and I mean, this will be, I guess, the series that defines you, Philip. How does that feel to you?
Well, I think you're probably right. I didn't intend that to be the case when I began it, but I am, what am I now, 79 or something? I don't think there's going to be another big trilogy. There might be some shorter books.
But
it might be my memoir of Australia.
I would love to read that. Are you done once and for all with Lyra and that story?
I don't know. I've written a number of little books, basically short stories in book form. I wrote Lyra's Oxford and the story about the going to the north and a couple of other stories in that sort of format and set in Lyra's world. And I think there might be a few more like that. But I don't think any more long books about Lyra. She knows where she is and she knows what she's going to do now.
And Philip, you know, you told us you are 79. You've been writing books for more than 50 years. Does it get easier?
No, it gets harder because the more experience you have, the more possibilities you can see in each scene that you write. It could go that way. It could go this way. It could go another way entirely that I hadn't thought of. So it's not, this is like what I was saying about planning. You see all the possibilities. So it's harder in that sense, but in another sense, it's easier because it's something you've done before. You know, writing a book of 200 pages, 300 pages long was daunting when I started, but I did the first one and I thought, well, yeah, I can do that. You've got to stay at your desk for a long time, but it's possible. So you know that's possible. So it's both harder and easier in different ways.
Well, Philip Pullman, it has been such a pleasure to meet you today. Thank you so much for making the time and congratulations on The Rosefield.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
And the final book in Philip Pullman's The Book of Dust trilogy is called The Rosefield and it's published by David Fickling Books. You're listening to The Book Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Claire Nichols, and actor-turned-author Zoe Tarakis is here now to take a fresh look at Greek myths. Zoe's first book is a collection of short stories that take those Greek myths we know, but this time they're bringing the queer and trans undertones of these stories right into the spotlight. The book is called Eros. Zoe, welcome.
Hello, how are you?
I'm great. And I'm guessing you have got Greek myths in the blood, right? I mean, your family is from Crete.
Yes, my family is certainly from Crete, the island of myth. So it is pumping in there somewhere.
Do you remember when you were first introduced to these stories?
Some of them. I mean, some of them I had to, you know, go digging for and only sort of found later in life. But yeah, I remember being fascinated by Greek myth and, you know, Egyptian myth as a kid. I think so many queer kids are, right? Like they're so dark and sort of sexual and there's something really alluring about them. They're like dark fairy tales or something, you know, which is pretty exciting for a little kid.
Yeah. I mean, this is interesting because obviously in this project, you're pulling out those queer undertones that are certainly there in those stories. But I'm interested to get some context here, Zoe. When you were reading these stories as a kid, did you have a sense of your queer identity at that time or was something in those stories just already speaking to you?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly, it was nothing I had language for, that's for sure. But I think, so because queerness and transness in Greek myth and really most mythology is pre-language or pre-identification, there's something really beautiful in that as a kid where you don't have language. And even if you did, you probably, you know, I certainly wouldn't have known what to do with it. And so looking at these women that turn into spiders and men that turn into sea monsters. And, you know, there's a transformation in it that I think as a queer kid is really easy to see yourself in, even when you don't entirely know what it's about. And yeah, that's something I tried to lean into quite hard in the stories.
Yeah, it's a conversation I've had with other queer writers, you know, about werewolf stories and things like that as well. It's always that sense of transformation, right?
Yeah. Vampire story, like it's really that massive change that completely reframes the way you see the world. Like I think that's why queers especially who, you know, often things aren't written about us and so we have to use our imaginations to envisage ourselves in these stories that were traditionally written for men. You know, I think that's why we can relate to the werewolf stories and the vampire stories, you know, they're really intrinsic to our experience.
And of course, with the Greek myths, as we've been discussing, I think they've always been a bit queer. You know, just think of like Achilles and Patroclus.
Yes.
But those queer undertones haven't always been made explicit in the way we talk about these stories. Why do you think that is?
Straight men really like their heroes to be straight men, frankly. And I think, you know, because of the Christianity that, you know, sweeped through Europe and the world really not long after, it became inconvenient that our heroes were queer, or that our heroes were trans, or that our heroes were women, or that, you know, even that our villains were, you know, like that became any powerful character, the fact that they had femininity or transsexuality or queerness is quite inconvenient to heteropatriarchy. And so I think that's why they've been written out of history. And I think that's why, you know, also because they've been handed down to us by these historians who imbue them with shame. They are really our means of accessing these stories. And you have to dig past a fair amount of, you know, Ovid's opinion about lesbians before you get to the story of the lesbians, you know? And so I think it's just actually a process of stripping away. Well, that was my process, I suppose, just stripping away that voice until I got to the bones of the story.
Oh, why don't we take the first story in your book as an example? Yes. Help me with the pronunciations here. Iphis and Ianthe, how would we say this?
I say Iphis and Ianthe, but a lot of people say Iphis, and I'm starting to think I'm the wrong one.
Well, you're the author today, so we'll say Iphis and Ianthe. Maybe let's go to the story as we traditionally know it. What is the kind of traditional telling of this story?
Look, the traditional telling of this story is widely debated, but in Ovid's telling, ultimately, it is about a young girl, quotation marks, in Crete. Her father says to the mother when she's pregnant, if this child is born a girl, we have to kill it. So the mother's like, okay, well, uh-oh. And then the goddess Isis from Egypt travels over to Crete and says, raise this child, a boy. So as per Ovid's telling, Iphis does not want to be a boy. This is a girl trapped in the body of presenting as a boy who falls in love with her best friend, Ianthe. And on the day before their wedding, Isis comes over and grants Iphis a penis, because Iphis and Ianthe would have to have sex after their wedding. And I just found all of this so wildly unbelievable that two young queer people would have not had sex. Found that unbelievable. And I also just found it such a reductive, shameful telling of what looked to me like the story of a trans boy in Crete. Mm. And, you know, Ovid compares, in the voice of Iphis, says, you know, it essentially says it would be more humane were I to love a beast than another woman. And so that is just telling in and of itself that this is not a reliable narrator and a reliable voice. And so I kind of did as much digging as I could and got to the bones of the story. And, yeah, I was obviously pretty moved to find this story of a young trans boy in Crete, where my family's from, to whom the goddess Isis grants a penis. That was pretty extraordinary.
So tell us how you have reimagined this story, because all those story beats are there.
Yeah.
But I guess the emphasis is different, right?
Yeah, that's a beautiful way of putting it. Yeah, the emphasis is different because, I mean, I guess like every other person who's retold these stories, they've just taken the bones of the story and added their opinion, really. And I have not done anything different. I've taken the bones of the story and I added my opinion, which is that these young people are beautiful and what happens here is magic and is divination, not damnation. That's my opinion.
And their love story is beautiful.
Yes, of course. Of course. There's so much like violence in Greek myth. And that's something, you know, as you know, I don't shy away from in the book, but I think if you're not going to shy away from the violence, it also means you have to run headlong towards the love whenever it's there.
Well, Zoe, I'm hoping you might be able to read to us from your telling of Iphis and Ianthe. This is from when Iphis is a young person and they've just been told this big secret by their mother. They've been raised believing they're a boy, but now they know they have this big secret of their body that they have to keep.
I mourn the boyhood I deserved, one without hiding, without shame. I've long swallowed that mourning with gratitude. I'm lucky to be alive. I should be grateful. I guilted myself. I am grateful to be alive. I also grieve a childhood spent largely in shame and loneliness. I've learnt that these two things have to exist at once. After my mother told me everything, I became most comfortable on my own. Solitude was my greatest and safest accomplice, and nature my best friend. I climbed the trees and told them of my secrets. I did not fear the flowers nor the birds. They did not judge me. Where I saw abnormality and, at my darkest, deformity, nature saw invention. I worked with my father in the field. It was hard work. My body ached with it. And although Mum was always careful to explain that he didn't want to have to kill a daughter, a part of me couldn't look at him without remembering that my imaginary cock was all that kept me alive. My dad was so proud of his son. And it felt good. And it felt empty. Nighttime sheltered me in a way the day never could. Daylight brought a sense of exposure, a constant looking over my shoulder. Even in my most present moments, eating peaches fresh from the tree, feeling the sun hot on my face, there was always one part of me standing just outside myself, keeping watch, until I met Ianthe.
And that's where the love story begins. That's
yes.
Zoe Tarakis reading from her short story collection, Eros. There's a line there that I love, nature was my best friend. This is a reoccurring theme throughout this book, right? This connection between these young queer people, these young trans people and the natural world.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think nature and queerness and nature and transness are inextricably linked, and nature and Crete are inextricably linked, you know, so there was kind of this overlap that, I mean, I experience as a person who lives with both those identities, that it felt like a loss to not give that relationship to these, or not even give, to explore that relationship that these characters have to the world around them, you know, because myth and nature are one, really. Myth just tells the stories of the nature. And so, yeah, it would be remiss of me to not have nature be such a pivotal part of these characters' journeys.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever read a book that has made me want to go for a swim more than this book. It just sounds
that's
so gorgeous.
Awesome. That's great.
And I think, you know, there's lots of fun with these stories as well. I laughed in one story where you basically ask, you know, what if Eurydice would prefer it if Orpheus just didn't bother trying to follow her to the underworld? I mean, this is fun as well, right?
Yeah. I tried so many times to write that story the traditional way. I was like, come on, find a way to like him, find a way to like Orpheus. And I just couldn't, and I gave up. And so I got rid of him.
I think you're also having a lot of fun with the sex in these stories. I've got to tell listeners, these stories are really, really sexy. Tell me about the joy of writing these sex scenes.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. It's something that I don't think I was necessarily aware of how much sex was in the book until I started doing interviews about it where people were like, so tell us about the sex. And I was like, oh, there's a fair bit in there, isn't there? So that's sort of been about reflecting with hindsight. But yeah, it was a joy to write. I mean, it's so, you know, like it didn't necessarily feel political while I was writing it. I was just, it's, I'm a wog and that's how I relate to people. And it's also how I've, you know, think it's, I find it a really beautiful way of exploring how somebody feels in their body or in relationship to somebody else or in relation to the world around them. But also I think, you know, with hindsight, I look at the sex in the book and I think, you know, trans people have their sex and their sexuality weaponized against them so readily from so many different directions. And I think it is quite pacifying and it can make trans storytelling or the stories that trans people are allowed to tell feel really overly innocent or something. Mm-hmm. Like we're not people with wants and needs. We're just people who aren't a threat, you know? I think that we're so focused on telling stories where trans people aren't the threat that we actually lose any three-dimensionality at all. And so it's been really, it's been awesome to sort of reflect on the book and see it as a, I guess, a reclamation of our sex and going, you know, just because you think our sex is a threat does not make it a threat. And yeah, and so I think having a, a lot of trans sex in the book was really important and I feel really happy for trans people to be able to read a book where they can see their sex represented, you know, in a way that's hot and fun and weird and sexy, you know, and maybe cis people learn a thing or two as well.
So I'm Zoe Tarakis, you've had a very successful career as an actor. You've been in shows like Wentworth and Nine Perfect Strangers, films like Talk to Me. Tell me, what inspired this shift to fiction?
Yeah, it kind of crept up on me, to be honest. I think, yeah, if I'm being completely honest with you, a frustration with the kinds of stories that are available for trans people.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, when fascism rears its head, arts industries get scared and they get poor. And that means just a massive recession in the types of stories that are being told. You know, it felt like we had this period of expansion around, you know, 2019, 2020, and then the walls are just packed it in, you know. And so I started to just get a bit frustrated, I suppose, with how few and far between these trans stories were and then the nature of the ones being told were so depressing, to mm-hmm. be honest,
mm-hmm.
and so not why I became an artist and why I think a lot of trans people became an artist is not just to sort of be the moral lesson in a cis person's world. And so it was sort of born out of that. And, you know, I think as well, you know, we had a real rise in turfism in around 2022, 2023. And I think just being able to drown out the world a little bit, like writing is quite a private exercise.
Yeah.
And being able to turn off the world a little bit and engage on my own terms and try and outweigh the rhetoric being used against my community with the rhetoric that's used inside my community. And spend time in trans stories that are vast and expansive and natural and sexy and affirming. You know, this is all to say it's been an immense privilege to get to do that and to spend time in these stories and has really changed my DNA and how I understand myself as a trans person in the world and in history.
Will you write more fiction, Zoe?
Yes, I actually am signed on to do a book, like a novel,
wow,
with Hachette, which is awesome. And I've just started writing that one. It's about a Cretan trans boy in the 90s in Sydney. And yeah, I won't say too much more about it just yet. But yeah, it's really, really exciting.
Well, congratulations on your debut. It's called Eros. Zoe, what a pleasure to meet you today.
So awesome to meet you. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for joining me for the book show today, where I spoke to Philip Pullman about the final installment in his The Book of Dust trilogy. It's called The Rosefield, and to Zoe Tarakis about Eros. And if you love the book show, please tell your friends. We have a whole back catalogue of interviews for you to enjoy. If there is an author you love, there is a pretty good chance I have spoken to them here on the book show. Make sure you and your pals are following the program on the ABC Listen app. We have all our past interviews there, plus you are primed and ready for everything that's set to come in 2026, starting next week with Trent Dalton. I'm Claire Nichols. Thank you to producer Sarah Lestrange and to operator Ross Richardson. We make the book show on the lands of the Wurundjeri and Whadjuk Noongar people.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.